You don't tell me what to do. Yep.
Uh-huh. Oh, no. Can't start Garrett 5 seconds early. Must start on time. Hey, everybody. I'm Kyle Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us is as smart as all of us around here. That's what we do.
That's right. I'm Molly Wood. It is Tuesday, which means indeed we're going to get some help getting smarter. It is time to dive deep into a single topic. Today, we are talking about school reopenings as we approach the end of the school year.
That's right. You know, right? We're squeaking in under the wire. My kids are going back to school full time, 4 days a week today, actually, with 3 weeks left in the school year. But
wow.
Yeah. No kidding. No kidding. Lots of small town conversation about it, that whole calendar and everything. But that's a whole different thing. The deal, of course, is this. This economy and thus life are not going to reopen until schools get back up and running in a substantial way. One government survey says about 54% of K through 8 public schools have reopened for in-person instruction. But as with my kids, at least part of that sometimes is on Zoom still. So there is much left to do.
And although districts have made various deals to go back, there is still a lot of uncertainty. There's uncertainty about parents and whether they'll feel comfortable sending their kids back. Some teachers still are saying they don't want to go back. So we're headed into summer with the fall a little bit up in the air, and we wanted to just dig into that a little bit. Here to make us smart is Valerie Strauss, who covers education for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I guess we should start with kind of what are you hearing on the ground? Is this kind of sense of uncertainty widespread? Is it just us?
No.
Should we be more hopeful?
It's from coast to coast, top to bottom of the country. There's uncertainty everywhere, despite, you know, the increasing number of vaccinations. As you noted, most K through eight schools are open, but that doesn't mean that most kids are there. In urban districts, for example, strong percentages of particularly students of color are not back. Even students who are back, by and large, don't go 5 days a week. You noted your kids are going 4 days a week, but some are only going 2 days a week or 3 days a week. And then you have the other thing, which is that even when some kids go back, they're still working on their laptops with the teacher who still might be at home, or with the teacher doing a hybrid, which is teaching kids in the classroom and teaching kids who are at home online at the same time, which changes the way a class is led, and it changes the experience for everybody. And teachers have different feelings about who's getting short shrifted, the kids at home or the kids in the class, but usually some group is. Mm. So it's a really confused time for everybody.
Yeah, the whole Zoom in a room thing is what my kids were calling that. So let's talk about some of the impediments, I guess, to normalcy. The first and biggest, obviously, is the disease and its transmissibility in schools. What do we know about that, just sort of epidemiologically speaking?
Broadly speaking, kids have turned out not to be big community spreaders when they go to school. And there are some districts that have been open literally for all year, even 5 days a week. And while there have been some transmissions and a lot of disruption when whole classrooms go into quarantine for days or weeks at a time because somebody has contracted it or somebody's been close to somebody who contracted it, the numbers don't show massive community spread from school openings. That doesn't mean there hasn't been recently in Michigan when kids went back to school. There were a lot of cases, more than they expected. But by and large, they're not big community spreaders.
Should we assume, even with vaccines in play, and you know, teachers in most states, as I understand it, have been able to get early access to vaccines. But should we assume that there is still going to be some hybrid learning in the fall?
Hmm. Yes, I think we absolutely should assume that. It looks like most districts are still planning for that. They are trying to upgrade the virtual offerings that they had over the last year, many of which were awful. And there are a growing number of of parents and students who want it, some of them at different grades for different reasons. There are still, in communities of color, there's still resistance to going back. Everybody hasn't been vaccinated. Those communities have been hit harder. The hybrid situation doesn't make sense for a lot of working people because they still, if they have to work 5 days a week and have their kids home 3 days a week, it almost is easier just to keep them home. Then you have you have a lot of high school students who have gotten jobs and want to do things virtually because they don't want to give up their jobs. Their parents may have lost their jobs and they went out and got something to help with the family and they're not ready to stop that. So there are varying reasons, but school districts know that a lot of families want virtual education. Some of the districts are going to try to persuade parents to send their kids in and not do virtual. And there's one district in California, for example, that's not going to try not to even offer virtual, sort of to force the kids back in. And that's for, you know, a variety of reasons. It's for funding reasons per, you know, each student who comes, you get paid for by student. And because if we've learned anything over the last year, it's that for most students, in-person learning is better.
Could you talk a little bit about the power of or the perceived power of the teachers' unions in these conversations? Because they have been right at the very front of a lot of the get back to school talk, certainly in the big cities.
They have. At the very beginning of the pandemic, teachers were hailed as being heroes and everything was wonderful. And then, as usually happens, they and their unions were attacked and accused of trying to keep schools closed. The unions, first of all, unions, they don't act as monoliths. They're not one big monolith. There's two different national teachers unions. There's state and local chapters. The national unions can't really tell the state and local chapters what to do, even though there's that perception that they can. Some unions have been very reluctant and insistent, frankly, on not sending their teachers back until they were vaccinated. You even have some that have not wanted to send their teachers back after being vaccinated. You also, though, have some unions that want schools to open but still don't feel safe because the school districts aren't doing what they promised to do in terms of fixing conditions that, frankly, were bad before the pandemic. But, you know, major issues with HVAC systems and things like that are not easy to do. They're expensive to fix. And schools, even with all the federal help, schools didn't have enough and still don't have enough to do all the fixes that they have to do to make it a completely safe environment when you have a virus that still exists and is still changing. It's still coming out with new variants, and nobody knows if the vaccines will be effective against the new ones.
What do you think? I mean, I think there's no doubt that all emotions are raw across the board, certainly yes. When it comes to this question of school, you know, and who wants to go back and who is willing and who is able. What is that going to look like? What are these really? Because, you know, schools are communities and yes. Parents rely on teachers and teachers rely on parents and administrators rely on parents to be involved and raise money and all of these things. And there is really, I think, a lot of anger and frustration between parents and teachers and administrators. I mean, how are these relationships going to get repaired even as we try to figure out how to educate kids?
That's a really good question. And it's clearly going to have to take time. Some parents, interestingly, who have long supported unions have turned against their local chapters because they don't understand why teachers won't go back inside. There's been some publicity lately about how the CDC, for example, checked in with the teachers' unions before giving advice on how schools could open. That's actually not what happened, but that's the common lore. What the CDC did was check in with all kinds of groups, including the teachers' unions, and the teachers' unions didn't have any more of a say than any other parent groups or education groups or other things. But so there's a lot of a lot of parents have heard these kinds of things, and again are upset that their teachers aren't going back in when they wanted their kids back in. And to answer your question, I think it's going to take time. I think it's going to, in the fall, school's not going to look like it did before the pandemic yet. There will be people out. There still may have to be social distancing, probably more of 3 feet than 6 feet. But if they do three feet, the fact is they won't be able to get all the kids who, let's say everybody wants to go back in. They can't. They're going to have to change somehow. They're going to have to either have different sessions of schools like they were doing in a couple places, or different days. So it's not going to look the same. It's all going to take time. I think ultimately parents need teachers, and teachers need parents, and so they find ways to repair it. But it will be difficult.
Can I, unusually on this podcast, can I be the voice of hope for a second here? Because with yesterday's news that the FDA has approved the emergency use authorization for 12 to 15-year-olds for Pfizer, and the CDC expected to give whatever blessing they have to give tomorrow, and then Thursday those shots can start getting in arms, we will have the opportunity to have every kid who wants to, or their parents, from 12 up, be vaccinated by, you know, the beginning of August when school starts, certainly out here and in some other places through the country. Do you think that plays into the normalcy factor at all?
In some places, absolutely. I think it absolutely will help. I don't think it will make everything normal, but it still is on that spectrum of moving toward normal. It will certainly help. You still have a lot of vaccine resistance, though. And it remains to be seen how many parents are going to want to get their child vaccinated. Mm. There, even before the pandemic, there was strong vaccine refusal. And a lot of school districts actually sort of let it slide. But they're not going to be able to do that with the COVID vaccine. The other thing is, another question people are wondering is, at some point, will schools or health departments in those areas require the COVID vaccine? And then what happens when parents refuse to do it?
Right.
So in terms of being a voice of hope, absolutely. I mean, things will proceed more toward normalcy or a new normal that hopefully will be better. There's no reason to think that we will constantly be in this state of uncertainty and fear. I don't think that's true. I just think that anybody expecting that to happen for the start of the new school year, we'll be disappointed. I think we're moving along towards it.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that has come up is this question of how difficult it is, or whether it is difficult to do this kind of dual teaching, right? The version where some kids are at home and some kids are in the classroom. As someone who's job did change dramatically. I think everyone's did. Like, is that seems solvable and like a model that has some potential for kids, right? And teachers? Well, like, is it that hard? I really don't know.
Yes, it's that hard.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not only
what's
that
hard. Help us understand.
What's hard is for a teacher to be having to do both things at the same time. You're trying to, there's different approaches in doing a virtual lesson and doing one in class. So you can't do both at the same time. Now, what some districts are thinking about doing is having some teachers solely do virtual and then other teachers solely do the in-person. And that offers a model that's worth considering and could be of good value. Having one teacher do both, the truth is, puts a double burden on teachers because you have to adapt one lesson to another. It's not the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, a play isn't the same thing as a movie. And so splitting it up among the workforce and having virtual teachers who do virtual and teachers who do just in class makes a lot of sense because they can then focus on those populations.
Yeah. Is that happening? Do you know?
It's starting
I'm wondering to what extent schools are rethinking the opportunity with the fall in mind.
A lot are. I think from the data that we've seen, most districts are planning to offer virtual options for the fall. To what extent that is, we don't know. But they are all rethinking it because everybody, if there's one thing people agree on, is that virtual for most kids was not sufficient and in many cases was an utter disaster. So some districts are actually creating their own district schools for online to provide a complete alternative. Some districts are thinking about letting kids do some online and some in school. So what this could, you know, over the next few years open up is a lot more opportunity to have individualized schedules. We'll see if that happens. Yeah, sure. You know, the human tendency is usually to fall back on what you know, but it could be that this could start something where there's more individual agency about a school day.
Valerie Strauss is an education reporter at the Washington Post. Valerie, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's still a mess.
There you go.
Still a mess.
So it's still a mess. So basically still a mess. And I keep trying, I mean, you know, there's a couple months, right? Like we're not, the conditions on the ground today will not be the conditions on the ground tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I think for everybody who's sort of still hoping and praying that it's just like going to flip a switch in the fall and everything will be fine. Sounds like
that's what I was
maybe like I was 80% fine.
I was hoping to pray that. Oh man. All right.
I'm gonna keep doing that. I'm gonna keep hoping and praying. But yeah, I think probably, you know, things will remain changed, shall we say.
Yeah. All right. We are at the break. Send us your comments on what you heard today, or frankly any day. Email or voice memo. Voice memos are better. Make me smart at marketplace.org. We are coming right back. If there's a speaker.
All right.
I keep hearing weird things. I don't think it's my headphones.
Oh, really?
Wait. Yeah, I don't know. Whatever. Oh, whatever.
I don't know. My speaker was on. There I just discovered. Right. So it might have been me.
Who knows?
Hey, thanks. Thanks,
yes.
Boss.
Yes.
I fixed the radio
thing. There you
thing.
Go. There you go.
All right. What do we think? Kay. News fix.
All right.
Look, someone turned my links into headlines.
I know. Well, I figured I would do a little housekeeping on the rundown. So all
thanks,
you have to
man.
Do is single click on the link, and then there's a little pull down thing that comes up, and it says replace link with the title of the article, and you click on yes, and boom, you're done.
Get right out of this town.
Yes.
Wow. Thanks for the tech tip, Rizdahl.
Neat and tidy. I like my rundowns neat and tidy.
I mean, I love it, but I was like, I'm not going to paste this in and then reformat it and then add the link to it.
Oh, automation,
my biscuits.
Baby. Automation.
Oh, my God. I can't wait to try this. This is so exciting.
You're on your own. You're on your own
See,
from now
you do
on.
Get smarter on
the,
our show.
The training wheels are off. All right. I've got like 1.2 items here. The 0.2 is a quick and dirty. As predicted, gas prices are going up and there are shortages in some states on the East Coast because of this Colonial Pipeline ransomware thing that happened. Average gas now tipping right at $3 a gallon, which is a lot, highest since 2014, nationwide, of course, because out here in California, it's like $17 a gallon or something.
Yeah.
And then shortages like people pulling up the gas stations in Georgia and some in Alabama and not having any gas. It's going to go away, right? It's a bottleneck, but it's illustrative of the size of the problem, which is potentially ginormous, as we talked about yesterday. Item number two for me, which is my full item, is a thing today that I saw in the Wall Street Journal. It's from a journal conference called the Future of Everything Festival. The woman who's in charge of engineering at Google says that Google is going to double the size of its team studying artificial intelligence ethics in the coming years. Doesn't give a deadline, which is kind of troubling given Google's history on this. And Google's history on this is really not great because it was like late last year, where they, in essence, dismissed a woman who was working on this, a very prominent woman by the name of Timit Gebru. She went public. It turned into a big brouhaha, and Google, frankly, looked really bad. And the reason it's important to have ethics in AI, well, number one, because AI is going to rule our lives. And number two, Google's a leader in this field. And I just think it's really important that they now, one hopes, see the error of their ways and are going to staff it up. Not enough and not fast enough, but I'm going to take the small victory here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yep. So many thoughts on this. I mean, what I guess I will say, and hopefully they're addressing this as well, is you can bring in as many people as you want, but if you don't listen to them, support right. them, treat them well, or keep them, it won't matter. Yep. So there has to be a lot of cultural change that goes along with that. But yes, I mean, everyone should be doubling or tripling the size of their ethics in AI team,
right.
if that's what they're working
for
on.
Sure.
For sure. I also have sort of one and a half. One is that the FCC, just sort of in time for this conversation, approved this $7 billion emergency connectivity fund program, which will provide funding specifically for schools and libraries across the country for internet access in terms of Wi-Fi hotspots and broadband connections, but also laptops and tablets. Because there was not only, you know, did schools have trouble being online and getting online and having access for students and families, but students and even teachers couldn't always afford devices.
Right.
And so this is actually pretty, this is a big amount of money,
yep.
obviously, and is going to go directly to schools and families, which is pretty remarkable, actually.
Yeah, I think so too.
And then the other one that just was kind of one of those like world's tiniest violin things, but also like a sign of maybe the system isn't working right if the system doesn't work if Americans don't have tons of debt. Kind of, this is that desk. So the Wall Street Journal reports that Americans are paying down credit card debt at levels that are like unprecedented, haven't been seen in years, which is fantastic, right? You don't want Americans to have like all this incredibly high interest debt. I mean, credit card rates, even if you have good credit, it's like 16% on your debt. And it's compounding, and it's a freaking nightmare for people. And so it's great news for America that people are paying down this credit card debt, unless you're a bank and that's how you make all your money.
Yeah.
And so banks are freaking out because this is like a legitimate revenue concern for them. And so they are spending more on marketing. They're loosening. What could possibly go wrong? They're loosening their underwriting standards to get more Americans to accumulate debt.
Yeah, it's not great.
And it's just the part of the program where you think, maybe it's time to find a different way to make that money.
Yeah.
Because that is fundamentally extractive in a way that harms people, is my opinion. Anyway, it's fascinating. Loosening underwriting standards. Whenever you start to hear that, run in the other direction.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it.
There we go.
That's it for the
Garrett,
news fix.
Next little interlude from you, please.
Hello, Molly and Kyle.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Kelsey, Los Angeles, go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. So, love what you do. All right, your show last Tuesday mentioned people not wanting to go back to offices and cruises. Am I the only person who can't wait to go back to the office? The camaraderie, happy hours after work, quick whiteboard sessions with colleagues in an open conference room. Working from home just isn't the same. I end up doing dishes between meetings and noticing all the house chores I've been putting off. I know commutes suck, but do that many people really not mind the messy blend of work and personal life for the last year? I hope that there's enough people like me out there that there will still be offices to go to in the future.
This RT is an endorsement. I'm down with that. I can vote in favor of that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, people are right. We tend to just make these blanket statements about people not wanting to go back, and there will be a lot of people who don't want to go back, and a lot of people who do want to go back, and a lot of people who want to go back 2 to 3 times a week.
Yep.
And hopefully, I mean, I guess what I hope is that we will get to a situation where that can be accommodated. You know, you look at Google.
Yeah.
Not a good example of lots of things, but a good example of sending out a blog post that was like, we want our employees to have maximum happiness and flexibility, whether that's 2 to 3 days in the office, working in an office in another part of the country. One thing I thought was so clever is that Google's going to give people a work from anywhere week on the calendar. Like 1 week a year, it's not technically vacation, but we don't care where you're working from
which
where you are working.
Right.
Which is cool.
Yeah.
So yes, hopefully, Kelsey, what you're pointing out is that like not everyone wants the same thing, and we should accommodate lots of desires.
Right. Kelsey did also send us a question for tomorrow, which is, of course, what do you want on a Wednesday? And we will get to it tomorrow. So, you know, be like Kelsey and send questions and voice memos. and we'll get
and
you, on the
you
pod.
Get to be on two shows right. in a row. Boom. Head. Incentives. All right. We also got a voice memo from Bob after last week's deep dive on the birth rate.
Hey, Kai and Molly. I appreciated your episode about birth rate. My partner and I live in Seattle. We own a house, which is amazing and such a blessing. We deal with college debt that has kind of prohibited us in our finances and thoughts from having children. With the pandemic, that's totally changed. The Biden administration and the Trump administration had paused student loan payments. That helped us a ton in paying down debt. Now we're looking towards the future and it's still just really uncertain. I'm 34, she's 32. You know, we've got a little bit of time left to talk about it, but yeah, it's a constant mm-hmm. discussion and you know, who knows?
Yeah. So I think the theme of the podcast today, from schools to Kelsey's thing about getting back to offices to Bob about having kids, the theme of the podcast today is we just don't know what the future holds, like way more than we usually don't know what it holds, right? We you never know what's going to happen tomorrow, but you got some reasonable clue. We kind of don't have a reasonable clue now about the out years, as they say, you know?
It's really true. And even though that's kind of always true, you know, tomorrow is not promised.
Yeah.
Right now, it's so obvious. Tomorrow is promised to no one. I would say, though, we are also learning that help helps.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing to keep in mind.
That's a bumper sticker or something.
And debt doesn't. Yeah. Right. Okay, I'm done.
Yeah. All right. We end, as we always do, with the answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about? Colin in Memphis hits it today.
So something that I thought I knew as a teacher but found out later that I was wrong was that we couldn't go back into in-person learning the school year without total disaster. And I need to stress that I teach at a small, well-resourced private school, so we can't directly compare our experience with all other schools. But here we are near the end of the school year, and it's really been fine from a safety standpoint. Hmm. We've had teachers and students test positive many times and whole sports teams be forced back online a couple of times. But we've never had to send back everyone home, and learning has happened. Thanks for making us all smart.
That's an interesting perspective, right? And I think
the
thing about, you know, those tests and teams having to go home is that there's a at least there is in my neck of the woods, an oh my God factor, you know, that I think requires some getting over and some sensibility about it. But yeah, that's cool.
And in a weird way, thank you, Colin, because yes, like the more we do it, the more it will just be. Because the virus is not going to disappear. No virus is going to disappear. That's not going to happen. There's not going to be a scenario in which we are all of a sudden in a bubble of safety that cannot be pierced.
Yeah.
We have to adapt and test and monitor and prepare. We have to, because we can't do anything else. And it's great to hear that there are people who are living this reality and like it's working, right? Yeah. It's not such drama all the time.
For sure.
I love it. Thank you.
For sure.
Don't forget to send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question, which, of course, is what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? Send us all your thoughts, all your comments, makemesmart@marketplace.org. See you tomorrow. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and our smart speaker skill.
Sorry, I'm literally just checking if I have any new Alexas that I have to record. Uh-oh, I said it. Today's program, Garrett Lang was in charge. Liana Squalacci is going to mix it later. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer for today, and I think she's done, I don't know, is Bridget Bodner. She's going back to do the other thing she does. Donna Tam's coming back from vacation. Sitar Nieves, just because you people want to know, I know this. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. Well, you know, we're moving.
I feel like actually, yes, exactly. The real lesson of today's show is it is complicated.
That's right. There is no certainty. Everything is uncertain.
Ish is complicated.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.